remember. Where's your partner? Is she coming? Is she ill? Oh. Okay. Okay, they'll find us on the way. Morning, everybody. I hope you are all fine this morning. I am fine and my committee is fine. I feel this morning we are going to have a presentation by Chwaranang Legal Advocacy Center, that is an NGO, on the outcome of the study pertaining to the 10-year review of the Domestic Violence Act. Are they present? Are you comfortable from where you are? Are we fine now? So, Ranan, perhaps just before you start, if you could just tell us who you are, what you do, then we know who we are talking to. Thanks. Pardon us for that scratching around.
Chairperson, I'm also presenting on behalf of the Gender Advocacy Project. It's a joint presentation. Perhaps they would also like to introduce themselves as well. Just to begin with, Chwaranang. We are a non-governmental organization of two offices. One is based in Braamfontein in Gauteng, and the other is in Eikelhoek, Mpumalanga. And I think very broadly you could describe our work as having two components. The one is our paralegal advocacy service, which operates from both Eikelhoek and Braamfontein, and we provide a whole range of paralegal advice and support to women who are experiencing domestic violence, some form of sexual offence, divorce, customary marriages, and deceased estates. So we provide a good deal of the practical assistance, and with that we try to draw from our clients' particular problems to use that as a base for informing law and policy. which is the other aspect of our work. It's the research, the policy, and the development of law, the intervention in law. We've sometimes been involved in bringing cases that have looked at changing law, the one example being the matter of Masir a couple of years ago, which looked at widening the definition of rape, which involved a young girl who had been anally penetrated. So I think very broadly you could describe our work as a combination of direct services and then research leading to policy, advocacy, and legislative work.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, chairperson, honorable members. My name is Tumelo Kosimele. I work for the Gender Advocacy Program. And as Lisa had mentioned, the presentation is a joint presentation between the Gender Advocacy Program and the Taranang Legal Advocacy Center. GAP is a non-profit independent gender advocacy and lobbying organization, NGO, that was begun and is based in the Western Cape. And we originated as a grassroots initiative. GAP strives for gender transformation in South Africa by lobbying civil society, political structures, and decision makers for a gender-just society that will empower marginalized communities, particularly women, to gain social, political, and economic equality. To achieve this, then GAP conducts research. GAP conducts training with communities and women in particular. We engage in advocacy and lobbying activities to inform, to build capacity, to link civil society, to mobilize civil society, to advocate for gender-just legislation, for gender-just policy making, for gender-just decision making at all levels of government. GAP has recently prioritized strategic activities through the generous financial and strategic support of the Heinrich Boll Foundation, who I believe are here today, HBS. And as part of these strategic activities, this year GAP will be hosting two seminars, one on the Domestic Violence Act sometime in September, and another one on the SADC Gender Protocol on Gender and Development. And members are welcome to attend these, and details will be given to members closer to the time. I would like to thank the committee for inviting us to come through, and I will hand over to Lisa to continue the presentation.
Thank you very much. And again, I would also like to take the opportunity to thank the committee for being given the time to present this overview of the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act for the last 10 years. While the Act was passed in 1998, it only came into effect into 1999. So I think this is a very opportune time for us to examine what has happened in the last 10 years since it has come into effect. What I'm wanting to focus on in the presentation is just give a very brief overview, I think, of some of the health consequences of domestic violence, because I think they're a very good reminder as to why this is a problem that we urgently need to do something about. And then I'm going to look at the various studies that have been done over the last 10 years that will give us some idea of what is actually happening. There's some 14 studies that have been done over the last while, and I think they give us a picture, which when we add it together, we can start to see where the common themes are and some of the challenges. In addition to that, I think once we look at some of the practicalities of implementation, I want to conclude by looking a little bit at what could be some of the ways forward, and possibly some suggestions to Parliament if they don't mind me making them. We are still looking for the presentation, which I think is opening. I think I will go ahead in the meantime. I don't know if the members have copies of the PowerPoint. Okay. Right, I think just to begin with. No. It's that one. Thank you.
Do we all have the copies? We have them. Okay.
I think the first slide is just setting out some of the fatal and the non-fatal outcomes of intimate partner violence. I think just to look at, if we look at the fatal outcomes, which would include both murder and suicide, research Effing Harris, undertaken in 1999, found that half of all South African women murdered in that year were killed by their intimate partners. And the prevalence rate calculated from that suggests this was the highest rate of such killings that had yet been found in research internationally. Unfortunately, no one's looked at the role of domestic violence in precipitating women's suicides. But if we look at some of the non-fatal mental health outcomes, these are also very serious. They include suicide, attempted self-harm, alcohol and drug abuse, depression, anxiety, and eating disorders. I think it's also worth pointing out that the South African Trauma Survey, which was conducted in 2006 and included a full-spectrum South African female population, found that domestic violence caused the greatest number of cases of post-traumatic stress disorder amongst women. So I think we can see from that the very serious impact it has on women's mental health. So I think if we just look at the non-fatal outcomes, they include disability, disfigurement, headaches, backaches, physical injuries, including from minor to severe. I think women who've ever been physically or sexually abused are also more significantly more likely to describe their health as poor or very poor. This is extracted from the World Health Organization's International Domestic Violence Survey carried out in 15 countries. I think what they also found from the interviews they did with women in the study, that abused women are much more likely to have had difficulties carrying out their daily activities and walking, having experienced memory loss, dizziness, pain, and vaginal discharge. I think another important finding of theirs was that recent ill health was associated with a lifetime experience of violence. So they suggest that the experience of abuse on an ongoing and cumulative basis has an extremely dire effect on women's health, or that the physical abusive effects, the physical effects of the abuse, even if they're not felt immediately, continue to linger long after the abuse is over. So I think the importance of this particular study is it shows that the consequences aren't just confined to immediately after the abusive incident, but that they continue and linger and poison women's lives for a very long time afterwards. I think just looking at some local research, one study done in three provinces found that between 35% to 60% of women had been injured as a result of domestic violence in the year prior to the study. I think it's also important that we look at the reproductive and sexual health outcomes and the consequences of domestic violence. And here one can see they don't only affect the woman, but they will also affect her child. So I think children, where we've had, there have been beatings reported during pregnancy. One has seen babies, stillborn babies or low birth weight babies. One has seen unwanted pregnancies, sexually transmitted infections, pelvic inflammatory disease, premature labor, and a whole range of other factors associated with maternal health. I think also, again, returning to the World Health Organization, that women who'd ever experienced physical or sexual violence or both were much more likely to report induced abortions and miscarriages than women who had never experienced partner violence. I think, again, returning to South Africa, the three province survey that I referred to earlier spoke about how between 5 to 9% of those women had experienced violence during their pregnancies. And then a study undertaken at a Durban hospital found that 35%, nearly a third of women, had been beaten during their current pregnancy. I think what is also of very great significance is noting the intersection between domestic violence and HIV. And I think we now have research both from South Africa and Tanzania that suggests that women who live with controlling and violent partners are at much greater risk of HIV infection than women who live with partners who are take a more equal approach to relationships. And I think it's not just the likelihood of infection that we have to look at in relation to HIV, it's also women's ability to complete their treatment regimes. And here again, I think we have some research predominantly undertaken in Zambia that has looked at how when women are already positive and attempting to take their antiretrovirals, living with an abusive partner interferes with that. It leads to difficulties in complying with treatment regimes. Women may sometimes skip their pills because they're hiding their medication elsewhere because they haven't told their partner for fear of his reaction, which obviously leads to an increase in their ill health. And, of course, in very severe cases, their actual treatment may fail. So given that outline, I think to give us a sense as to exactly why domestic violence is an important problem, and to give us a sense of why it is that we must attempt in some way to do something about it. The Domestic Violence Act, I think, is probably the most important and significant intervention by the government to try to address the problem of domestic violence. I think just giving you a brief history, before 1993, there was nothing. Women either had to go to the High Court at very great cost and employ an advocate in order to obtain an interdict, or they went to the local regional magistrate's court and obtained a peace order, which basically, I think, really put domestic violence on a par with dogs that bark too loudly, neighbors who make a noise and have parties all night, because that is what you use peace orders for. But I think in 1993, we saw a shift with the introduction of the Prevention of Family Violence Act. And I think the importance of this particular act was that it criminalized rape in marriage. Before that, no husband could have been prosecuted for raping his wife. Then, I think in 1998, due to some of the problems with the Prevention of Family Violence Act, the Domestic Violence Act was introduced. And that then came into effect in 1999. I think the act is, of course, not the only intervention by the state into the problem of domestic violence. We also have some policies and guidelines that support it. And this includes the policy framework and strategy for shelters for victims of domestic violence, which was issued by the Department of Social Development in 2003. And then the police, as well as the municipal police, also have national instructions guiding how they should address and intervene with domestic violence. And I say the municipal police have not been a very well-studied or well-investigated group as to how they deal with domestic violence. And then last year, there were guidelines for the implementation of the Domestic Violence Act issued for magistrates. So that is the policy and legislative framework that currently exists in terms of attempting to address the problem of domestic violence. I think just to give you a sense now of what is the use, how do women do it, what is the extent which women turn to the police and court for help? These are some of the figures that are available. I mean, this first one indicates that 157,391 protection orders were granted in 2004. And it's worth pointing out that this only refers to 70% of courts in the country. The other 50% of courts didn't return their information. So you can see that there is quite an extensive use of the protection order. For the first time, we got figures from the police last year that looked at crimes committed against women. Unfortunately, they didn't say what the relationship between the perpetrator and the victim was, but I think because we're looking at common assaults and assault GBH, we can probably pretty safely assume that much of this is going to be domestic violence. So you can see that between the periods specified there, there were 182,588 violent crimes committed against women, 91,534 were common assault, and 62,368 were crimes of grievous bodily harm. I think this is just one example. This is taken from our office in Aquinox, so that you get an idea of what a tip, a very small tip of a very much greater iceberg those reports are. We went to the hospital, the police station, and the three courts in the area and collected all reports of domestic violence made during an 18-month period. And we collected 942 different incidences of domestic violence. But I think what is important is that out of that 942, because we tracked women, we collected their names in every instance and tried to see if those names reappeared in the other records. And out of that, we found that only 63, or roughly 7% of those women actually pressed charges and would have become an official statistic. So 182,000 I gave you, as you can see, is very much a small figure. I think what was also quite disconcerting was that out of those 942 women, only three women used all three services. Only three women who went to hospital following an assault-related injury also went to the police and also obtained protection orders. Then out of 942, there were another 12 women who also went to the police and also applied for protection orders. And then we also found that some women had reported and gone to hospital. So I think the importance of this is that not only does it show us that we're dealing in official terms, that we're not only dealing with just the tip of an iceberg, but that we need to work a lot harder to increase referrals between organizations. And I think women who go to hospital having been injured and beaten very badly by their partners are not necessarily being referred to the police or obtaining protection orders. And I think in relation to hospital deaths, it was a concern that one in eight of those women had been to hospital at least once before during that 18-month period to be treated for an assault-related injury at the hands of their partners. What that is telling us is that people are seeing it not only once, but twice, and they're not intervening and necessarily referring women on to further help. In terms of the Act, I want to focus a little bit on the police before I turn to the courts. The Act is really, I think, although it talks about shelters and medical care, it doesn't really go into any great detail, and I think it's one of the weaknesses of the Act that I would like to talk about at the end. It really focuses and emphasizes the role of the police and the courts in dealing with domestic violence. So I'm going to look a little bit at what the researcher of the last while has been telling us about the police response. The first is that if you look at the police's instructions, it makes it very clear that the police must keep a record of assistance to complainants in either the station's occurrence book or in their pocketbooks, and all reported incidents of domestic violence must be recorded in the domestic violence register, not just those cases where a criminal case is opened. Unfortunately, not very many studies have focused on the police. I think they've been much more likely to look at what the courts are doing. So they've predominantly interviewed police officers, but I am going to give you a bit of a sense of what we're seeing based on both the independent complaints, directorate's reports, and the research that we did in Acorn Hook. So in Acorn Hook, we found that there were 416 incidents of domestic violence reported at the station. But out of that, only 19, or 15%, had actually made it into the domestic violence register. And I think what was also of concern was that for 6 months, the domestic violence register simply hadn't been kept. And when we asked the police officers what the reason for that might be, they gave us two answers. One was that they didn't know they had to put into the domestic violence register, and the other group said that they thought we, the NGO, were supposed to keep the domestic violence register. So it was very clear that there wasn't adequate knowledge of their responsibilities and duties. And I think also when we looked at the domestic violence register, the register should report if there'd been a breach of a protection order. And there were some breaches, which did mean that police should have arrested the respondent or given him a notice to appear in court. And when we looked at the register, we could see that neither of those things had happened. Where there'd been a breach, there hadn't been an arrest, and there hadn't been a notice given to appear in court. And this is not a problem that is unique in Acorn Hook. I think the ICD report on it consistently as a problem, and I think Western Cape studies have also pointed to this as being a problem, this question of record keeping. I think it's also worth pointing out that the police should have started submitting reports to Parliament every 6 months, within 2000. One of the obligations in the Act is to make such reports available to Parliament on a six-monthly basis. I think it is, as I said, worth pointing out that the very first time they actually submitted a report was in 2006. This is something that was, this is taken from the Independent Complaints Directorate. And what the ICD does is that they try to visit as many police stations as they can in a year and evaluate their compliance with the Domestic Violence Act according to a register or monitoring checklist that they've developed, which looks at all the requirements that are placed upon them in terms of the Act, and then they look to see whether those are being monitored. You can see that the number of visits is steadily increasing. This is from 2003 to 2008. And by 2008, in that year, they managed to visit 434 stations. The next slide looks at, of those stations that they were visiting, what proportion or what percentage of those stations could be said to have been 100% compliant with the Act's obligations. I think, if you remember, I spoke of 434 stations being visited in 2008. You can see from their 6 monthly reports that between January to June, only 14% of stations could be described as 100% compliant. And then for the other 6 months, 13%. So you can see the level of compliance is low. The best was the stations they visited in 2007, where almost half of those particular stations had reached 100% compliance. So I think what this is saying to us is that the police still have a very long way to go before they implement the Act fully, even 10 years later. If we look at the response, this is looking at what are the, in terms of the Act, the very particular obligations placed on the police. Now, just summarize them here. The Act says that the police must tell complainants of their right to apply for protection order and or lay a criminal charge. They must also assist the complainant to find alternative accommodation, shelter and counselling. They should also collect personal items from the victim's home and help them to obtain medical treatment if necessary. They must serve a notice from the abuser to appear in court as well as a final protection order. They can also arrest the abuser, and I think what is significant is that they don't need a warrant to do so. If they arrive on a scene and they are concerned that harm may result, they do have the discretion to go ahead and arrest without first applying for a warrant. And they may also remove any weapons from the abuser or from the home. This basically, and you can see they are quite extensive, those are the powers that the Act has granted to the police. Again, there hasn't been, I think, very much research looking at what the police actually do. So this, again, is taken from our office in Acorn Hook. And you can see that in a third of cases, the police don't do anything because they say they can't find the perpetrator, and that's it. They don't make return visits to see if they can find him. They don't make any further effort to see what's going to go on. You can also see that they don't even record what they do as the second most common response. You can see that they warn the perpetrator in about 14% of cases. But I think from what we could see, only 4.8% of police actually were advising victims to obtain a protection order. And from those who didn't want to pursue criminal charges, that suggests the police must have asked if the woman did want to. And then in about 7% they opened a case. So you can see that from this record of their responses, they are, again, not necessarily at all adhering to their obligations in terms of the Act. But I think it is worth pointing out that the ICD notes this. It's the most common complaint made to them. It's also, I think, in the recent case that we saw in 2006, that there is generally a problem around the police arresting those who breach the protection order. They generally don't. And I think to the extent that this case, White versus Minister of Safety and Security, involved a woman who had a protection order, had been assaulted, had called the police, they wouldn't arrest him and left. When they left, he raped her. So Mrs. White, very successfully, unfortunately, I would have preferred this not to have happened at all, but she did successfully sue the Minister of Safety and Security for the fact that the police had failed to carry out their obligations. That is an overview of the police. It is unfortunately quite a short one because, as I said, there hasn't been very much of an emphasis looking at what the police are doing. I think if we look at what the ICD is reporting, there's clearly quite a lot of room for improvement. I want to now have a little bit of a look at what the courts are doing. And I've given you a breakdown of the studies that have been undertaken as well as the provinces in which they have been done. And as you can see, most provinces have been covered. Free State hasn't had a very careful look at what's going on, nor has Limpopo at this point. But in most of the other provinces, there has been at least one study undertaken. As you can see, generally, no study has looked at more than three courts. I think part of the reason for that is, of course, the cost and the time of trying to do these studies. But I think when you add them all together, even though they're all quite small and scattered across the country, they all are starting to highlight some very similar problems. So even though we don't have a big national study, I think the fact that you find these same problems occurring in very different courts in very different parts of the country suggests that there are recurrent sets of problems. So then just so that you have a sense of who is using the protection order and why they're using it, I've just put in these slides. Firstly, I think what is very apparent is that women make up the great majority of protection order applicants. The number of men who turn to protection order does appear to vary quite widely. In the Northern Cape, we found that men made up only 13.5% of applicants, whereas at one court in Bellville, in the Western Cape, it was practically 30%. I think in addition to it predominantly being women who are seeking protection, women are also predominantly seeking protection from their intimate partners rather than other family members. But this also appears to vary across the provinces. One also sees, I think, a very important difference in the way in which men and women use the Act. As when women apply for protection, more than two-thirds of them are looking for protection from their intimate male partners. But when we look at men, only half of men are looking for protection from intimate female partners. The other half are looking for protection from their families. So there's a very big difference, I think, in men's use of the Act. men are about as likely to be looking for protection from usually their adult children and other adult family members as they are from female partners, whereas women are very much more likely to be looking for protection from their husbands and boyfriends. I think the question of money and economic dependency is one that comes up very often when we talk about domestic violence. And I think looking at these applications, they're starting to tell us something very important about the role of economics in domestic violence. And this data was taken from 9 courts in the 3 provinces of Eastern Cape, Northern Cape, and Northwest. And just from a statistical point of view, what an analysis of that data showed was that women abused by their male partners are very likely to be economically dependent. There's a statistically significant relationship between women being economically dependent and they're applying for a protection order. What is very interesting is that the men who apply for protection from their female partners are not economically dependent on those women. So their economic dependence is not a feature there where men are claiming to be abused by their female partners, but it's very much a feature of women who are saying they're abused by their male partners. One sees a completely different pattern for those who look for protection from their family members. And here, what this information is telling us is that those who abuse their family members, and these are usually the adult children, are often the ones economically dependent. So there it seems to be what we're seeing in terms of family violence is that the person being abused is the person who has the resources in the family, and that is why they are being abused, because somebody else in the family wants those resources. And as I said, it's usually the adult child. I think just in terms of looking at marital status, I think this is important to look at, is that married women are the group most likely to be applying for protection from the court. But there's also quite a high number of women who are separated or divorced from their partners. I mean, in Mpumalanga, this went to as high as a third of women. It's important to look at this because I think what it's telling us is that abuse doesn't stop when women leave, that it is continuing, and women are going to court for that. But I think what I'm also wondering, particularly in rural areas, is that quite often communities are not very accepting of married women who apply for protection orders and see applying for protection orders breaking up the relationship. So it seems that for some women, it's only when they leave that they might feel they can go and get a protection order because they won't be blamed for breaking up the relationship. What I think was a bit of a concern was the low number of cohabiting women applying for protection orders, fuss and sits or cohabitation relationships. The numbers, I said, were low. In one province, this was as low as about 6%, and it went up to 23% in the Northern Cape. Why I'm highlighting this is that the study I spoke about earlier that looked at female homicides suggested that women who are cohabiting are at much greater risk of being killed by their intimate partners than married women. So why that is a worry is it suggests that potentially those relationships are violent and abusive. And the question is, why are those women not coming forward to court? Why are they not seeking the court's protection? One possible suggestion, this came out of interviews in communities, was that police officers, community members, and courts don't take fuss and sit or cohabiting relationships very seriously. They don't think the partners are very serious. They think marriage is a much more serious relationship than the one they should intervene in. And so they're thinking that because this is not a legalized or recognized relationship, it's not one that they should really be paying much attention to. And the same goes for dating relationships. One certainly saw young women in here, 16 and 17-year-olds, who were looking for protection. But again, I think the attitude one was getting from police officers, courts, and community members were, these are just boyfriend-girlfriend relationships. Not important. But they are, because if abuse is starting so young and it's not being stopped then, you have to wonder what's going to happen to both the boyfriend and the girlfriend as they get older and perhaps move into other relationships. So we can already see from that data that it's a worry that cohabiting women are not using the protection order as much as they could. But there are other groups of people who don't seem to be using the protection offered by the Domestic Violence Act. The first group are younger children. I mean, I think the question is whether or not protection order is the best thing to get for a child that's being abused by their parents. I think there's better protection. But nonetheless, very few younger children are turning to protection order. Practically no same-sex couples. And I don't think that's because gay and lesbian relationships are much nicer than heterosexual relationships. I think the problem here is that very many, is that where there is abuse happening in gay and lesbian relationships, then the people in those relationships are very concerned about the homophobia and the stigma that they're going to experience if they go to court, and that's potentially what's putting them off, rather than that those relationships are less violent. And I think also a concern is the very low number of people with disabilities. I don't think, again, don't necessarily believe that men and women with disabilities are less likely to be abused. I think they face barriers in terms of getting to the courts. Courts aren't necessarily always that accessible to people with disabilities. So it's a concern that after 450 applications from Northern Cape, Eastern Cape and Northwest, where somebody looked at this, exactly 4 people were disabled. So I think, again, we're looking at barriers to use here from these low levels of people, of groups applying to the courts. And just as a last look at children in the Domestic Violence Act, from about 16 or 17 onwards, you start to see an old and an adult child being the family member that applicants are most likely to be looking for protection from. So I think we're talking about older and adult children as potentially behaving abusively and violently towards parents and other family members. But younger children we see almost never seek protection from a parent. The figures are very low, between 3% to 5%. But you can see in many ways that children are a shadow. They're a shadowy presence in the application for protection orders. Because the acts allow, in an application for the act, it asks you if anybody else, in addition to you, is being abused. And I think in almost all the studies, from half to about 70% of applications, people say, yes, there are other people being abused. I am not the only one. And I think when we look at who are the, when, and then ask, who are the other people being abused, and it is generally children. So I think what this is telling us is that domestic, that abuse, women abuse, is often going with child abuse. And that's an important point, because I think when we look at the interventions that are made, we keep child abuse and women abuse very, very separate. We don't see them as often going together and needing to be both addressed together. So this was just an overview to give you a sense of who's using the act and a bit of an idea as to what are the relationships between the people. I want to now look a little bit at what the courts are doing. And as we look at the police record keeping, I'm going to look a little bit at the court record keeping. And again, I think the importance of looking at record keeping is those records are the only evidence we have that somebody has ever applied for protection. If they get murdered, you will obviously want to know this information. If it's not there, it becomes a problem. If they're getting divorced, if they're seeking medical care, you want to know this information. Not only that, if you use up the first warrant of arrest, you have to go back to court in order to get another warrant of arrest. If the court hasn't kept record of your application, you have to go through the whole process all over again. So I think that is why one must look at record keeping and emphasize it as important. I'll just give you all studies talk about the fact that there is missing information at court. So I'm just going to give you Mpumalanga as an example. Here, I think, of the interim protection orders, some were missing. I think what became of more concern was the return of service. Now, the return of service is the proof that an interim protection order has been served. And a protection order cannot come into effect unless the other person knows that a court order has been obtained against them. And that interim order also tells them the date they must come to court in order to say why that protection order shouldn't be made final. So it is a highly significant document. If that return hasn't been served, then the final hearing doesn't go ahead. And basically it means that there's no protection offered. So it's of great concern that in our court in Mpumalanga, more than half of those returns of service were missing. There was no evidence that the protection order had ever actually been served. Then if we get to the final protection orders, which is also of concern, more than a quarter were not authorized. By this I mean the magistrate hadn't signed them. So they were worthless. They meant nothing. It doesn't matter that a couple of boxes had been ticked. If the magistrate hadn't signed it, it meant nothing. And then 19% were just missing. So effectively, almost half of those protection orders were not properly authorized. They were worthless. They were nothing more than a piece of paper. And then I think if we look at the warrants of arrest, because again, that is the strength of the protection order, is that it comes with a warrant of arrest. So that the minute there is a breach, that warrant can be executed. You don't have to run to court to go and get it. It already exists. Again, 6% not signed, so worthless. And again, copies of those warrants missing from almost 20% of files. So you can see, no record, no proof, no evidence, unauthorized documentation, therefore no protection. In this slide, what I've set out here from the provinces where we have information is attrition, or what I'm going to call, or what I'm meaning, is the loss of protection orders at every step of the process. So in this top column gives you the number of applications made in each province at those courts. So that's 100%. Then you can see out of that how many get interim protection orders. Northern Cape and Eastern Cape were low because of two of the courts. The magistrates took the attitude that only if you were likely to suffer very serious injury or murder should you get an interim protection order. Otherwise, you didn't get one, you would have to come back to court. So that's why the number of their interims is much lower than the other two provinces. So generally speaking, you can see that most of those who apply for interim protection orders are getting them. Then we look at where we are losing a whole lot of, women are being lost out of the system, is at that return of service. Only in the Eastern Cape were more than half of returns of service actually in the files. In all the other provinces, they were less than half. And that, to some extent, explains why so few women get final protection orders. Because only in Eastern Cape that more than half of women who actually applied for a protection order got it finalized. In the other provinces, we're dropping to 1 out of 3. So for some reason, you can see that the system is losing more than 2/3 of women, from those who apply to those who actually get the final protection order. And I'm going to give you a slide which shows, would explain some of the reasons why. Some of this is definitely due to the fact that some women get pressurized, sweet-talked, threatened, intimidated, and hit into not going back. But I think there are a lot of problems with the courts that are actually preventing women from going back. It's not just what the abuser is doing to them or them necessarily changing their minds. This also shows you, I think, at a couple of other courts in the other provinces, where again you can see that it's a few courts where more than half of protection orders get made final. The majority of courts, women don't get their orders finalized. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the return of service because it is such a significant step in the whole protection order process. As I said earlier, a protection order doesn't come into effect unless it's served. I mean, it is a fair point that somebody must know that something has been obtained against them. You can't go around arresting if they don't know that a protection order has been served. So in terms of the Domestic Violence Act, that interim order and the warrant for arrest can be served by the police, the sheriff, the clerk of the court, or others. Where the sheriff serves, the cost of service must be carried by the applicant. But if she can't afford fees, the court pays. The Act is very clear on that. Unfortunately, the Act said that there must be means testing, and that's the basis on which the courts decide whether or not the applicant can't afford. There are no criteria for means testing in place at court. So some courts simply don't even bother with the means test. They don't use the sheriff at all. In some courts, you'll find a situation where the clerk will have a look at how the woman is dressed, decide that she has on a very nice pair of shoes or a nice-looking dress, clearly she must have money from the way she's dressed, therefore they're not going to help. So I think because there are no criteria, it means that people use such arbitrary distinctions to decide whether or not someone deserves the court's help. I think what is useful is that in 1998, before the Act was even implemented, The GAP did an analysis of what money had been set aside by the Department of Justice towards the implementation, and already then they warned that the Department of Justice's budget for sheriff's fees was not enough. I'm just to give you a sense of what some of the costs of the sheriff's fees are. At Alberton Court, which was urban, Alberton is interesting because it's one of the few courts which uses sheriffs all the time. That almost never means test. They just give the service to everybody. It's an urban area. It costs R53.19 on average. You can see how the costs go up in rural areas. This is the average taken from two rural areas that used sheriffs. It was about R155 per application. So I think because courts haven't budgeted for sheriff's fees, we're not seeing sheriffs serve very often, but we're usually seeing the police serve. This slide will talk about argue that we should be encouraging the individual courts to start budgeting for the sheriffs because the sheriffs seem to be served much faster. And of course, the faster you serve the interim protection order, the quicker it comes into effect and the quicker you are protected. So, where we did have information about sheriffs, you could see that police serve half of the protection orders in 6 days and 3/4 of their protection orders within 15 days. The sheriff, however, serves half of their protection orders within 4.5 days and 3/4 in 10 days. So it does look like if you use the sheriff, you're going to give women protection faster because the order is going to be served faster. If we look at the police and the service of protection orders, and I think here is where we're going to start finding some of the reasons as to why there are so few returns of service. It's firstly, the police experience a shortage of vehicles. Some areas, in rural areas particularly, are very large. Some respondents are untraceable, they can't be found. I think what the police say, and I think it's valid, is they'll go to a house of 3 or 4 men. They'll ask, which one of you is so-and-so? And they'll say, no, we don't know who you're talking about. The police obviously don't know what this man looks like, so they're in no position to argue, so they leave. So I think there is a whole problem around what does one do in terms of assisting the police to identify who the respondent is. What some police are doing, and it may or may not be, I think, a dangerous option, is sometimes they ask the applicant to come with them so that she can point out which one is the respondent. And they can serve to him. But I think because finding the respondent can be so time-consuming, the police don't like doing it, and they do delay it in favour of what they think about maybe more pressing police matters. Because sometimes they've got to go back 3 or 4 times. And in rural areas, when you've travelled 100 kilometres to get there, no one's home, you're not going to make a priority to do that again if you have a shortage of vehicles. So I think that's it in the way. The other thing that one finds is that because they don't want to do it, whoever's on duty, when those interim protection orders come in, leave them on the desk and make them the problem of the next shift. And the next shift, as far as they're concerned, that didn't come in while I was on duty, I'm not serving it either. So those protection orders just get left to pile up there. So what happens sometimes is that the orders are then sometimes served after return date, after they were already supposed to be in court for the final hearing. The other serious problems are where, in some courts, neither the sheriff nor the police are serving. The clerk is actually expecting the woman to serve the order on the respondent. So they're giving it to her to say, you go and give it to the man who you say is abusing you. So that we were seeing at some courts. We were also seeing sometimes the clerk saying to the woman, okay, here's the order, you go to your police station and you fight with the police officer and get them to serve it. So I think there, again, is a problem. Also, I think the other problem is that although people were getting the interim protection order, they weren't getting the warrants of arrest. And again, that's the strength of the protection order. So it doesn't matter if you have the piece of paper. If you don't have the warrants of arrest, you can't act on it. So I think we're also seeing that as a problem. I think just here, looking at one of the recent case studies, 884 women, they found that 70% of them didn't get the interim warrants of arrest. And some of them didn't know if they had or hadn't gotten it. So I think, again, highlighting there's a real, real problem around this whole interim process, service of order as well as the warrant. So then I think, because we've done about 4 or 5 of the studies I've referred to, we tried to look at why are so few women coming back? Why are we losing, in some instances, more than 2/3 of women? What's happening? We weren't able to interview women, so we can't always say what their personal reasons might be for coming back. Those people who have interviewed women do point to the enormous amount of pressure being placed on them, not only by the abuser, but by the family, not to go ahead. Their fear, the fact that the abuser is now being terribly nice, making lots of promises. So yes, one has to take that into account. But what we looked at, and we ran some statistical analyses, and what we found is that, unfortunately, justice can be a little bit of a lottery. That at some courts, you are much more likely to get a protection order than at other courts. And I think this tells us a little bit about magistrate bias. That at some courts the magistrate will give you a protection order, other magistrates at other courts don't think you deserve one. And it's very much harder to get a protection order from those courts than at other courts. So I think there's obviously a training issue here. What you also saw seem to affect whether or not you get a final protection order is the type of relationship you're in. The courts seem much less likely to give a final protection order to the victims of family violence than to the victims of intimate partner violence. I don't know why that is. And that's why I spend so much time emphasizing the return of service process, that whether or not that return of service is served has an impact on whether or not you get a final protection order. If it's not served, you don't know whether or not you should come back to court. You don't know what date you should come back to court, and you don't come back to court. Not only that, I would imagine that for a lot of women, if you spent all that time going to court and your interim protection order isn't served, you wonder what on earth is the value of going back. So I think these are factors about the police and the courts that we have to look at because they are barriers. Yes, there are women who are going to change their minds, but there are barriers in the system and the structure that are actively preventing women from obtaining protection orders that we need to take steps to address. So then, just to conclude, and I think this is where some of the issues also come into effect, is looking at, all the studies have talked about the fact that the protection order and the Domestic Violence Act is under-resourced. And I think we can see that there has never been a budget specific to the Domestic Violence Act ever passed. Primarily, I think, because it was passed at a time when legislation wasn't costed beforehand. That has now changed, and I think departments are required to cost their legislation. But the Domestic Violence Act is one of the last pieces of law that we passed without having to cost. So I think because it's not being costed, there are a whole lot of problems with the resourcing, which you can already see coming up in a 2000 briefing by the Department of Justice. They said that the implementation of new legislation had placed, quote, severe pressure. The budget for personnel is less than that required for the number of approved posts. Fewer persons can therefore be employed. So I think the question is if the department realized this in 2000, why we haven't seen a budget subsequently developed in order to employ those additional personnel. We did some research to try and look at, well, what does it cost the state to serve protection orders? I think we looked at the cost of the police and the Department of Justice and calculated that each protection order probably costs about 245 rand and 3 cents. That's looking at the time, the personnel, and the time that they spend on doing protection orders. So roughly, for the, I said in 2004, we had figures for about 70% of courts. So roughly speaking, it would have meant that in about 2004, the police and Department of Justice would have spent about 38.5 million on protection orders. I'm just going to give you some comparisons to put that into our context. And it will also, I think, tell you where the priorities lie in terms of budgeting. If you read the police budget vote for 2000, they allocated 35 million for that year, 51 million for 2001, and 36 million in 2002, in addition to the existing allocations, to implement firearms legislation. So you can see in terms of what they allocate towards costs, firearms legislation is much more a priority than domestic violence. And again, I think giving you an indication that departments are perfectly capable of doing the thinking when they need to. In the 2004 budget verse address, the Minister of Safety and Security, again, committed 63.2 million to firearms control, just via vehicles, desktops, scanners, and printers. And then Justice has given 20 million towards security in the courts in 2002, which allowed the department to secure the houses of 32 judges. You can see that there is a spending on security of court personnel, but perhaps not as much as security of citizens. Cash and transit services, were security was offered at 8 million, and another 9 million for security fencing and lighting. And then in 2003, 45 million for security services at courts, which then the minister said wasn't enough. So you can see that if we look at these figures, much more is being spent on security on courts than security of individual domestic violence victims. What happens in the under-resourced courts? Well, firstly, protection orders only come into effect once they're served, so any delay in service jeopardizes the applicant's safety. Also, many courts don't have enough staff, and the emphasis is also on trained staff. From some of the courts I spend time in, you will have clerks telling you that lots of women abuse a protection order. They come there because they want the husband out of the house over the weekend so they can have the boyfriend in for sex. So So they'll quickly go and get a protection order, have him arrested so he's removed, and then they'll bring the boyfriend in. There is no evidence for that. Our Mpumalanga study found out of those 519 cases, exactly 3 breaches or arrests happened. So it seems hard to imagine that wide-scale abuse can be happening in the way that clerks are claiming. So again, I think that's a question of people not being properly trained on also at some courts, because they're not enough trained staff, the magistrates, and because unfortunately family law occupies a very low status in the legal system, is that magistrates will only consider protection orders once a week. They'll look at them on Tuesdays. So you can ask for protection on Thursdays, but you're not going to get it until Tuesday the next week when the magistrate looks at it again. And that's because there aren't enough staff. At some courts, there's no privacy. The applications are done in the general civil section along with deceased estates, maintenance, any other claims, so there's no privacy. Everyone can hear what's going on in your life. Also, I think because courts, there's not enough staff, courts aren't always very nice. The working conditions are shabby and there's understaffing. You have to also look at how that affects the people who work in courts. They get discouraged. And I think when they're not happy with their job, that often means that they treat the people who come looking for protection in an impatient, dismissive, and very short way. They're looking, because they're overworked, they don't want extra work. So any woman who takes a long time or doesn't know exactly what she wants or isn't completely literate and can't fill out the form by herself, they get impatient with because she's taking their time. So the understaffing, unfortunately, encourages court personnel to look at ways to cut the amount of time they spend on cases. So they don't explain the protection order properly, so she doesn't get proper protection. The application takes time, and it's not approved because the application is badly filled out. Under-resourcing shifts additional costs onto women. If they can't, if the court only hears protection order applications once a week, you have to make a double trip back, which costs you more money. And you have to pay for child, you either have to take your children with you, or you have to pay someone to look after your children, or if you're working, you have to explain to your employer why you need another full day of work. Who might give it to you, but will take your pay away from you for the day. So I think when we put all these extra hurdles in place, we also start shifting costs onto women. And I think finally, this is a broader problem. There are so few services, especially in rural areas, that the court can't give referrals for further help. So there are women who need shelters, but there aren't any. And what one is seeing in some instances, and I suppose it's a good move on the part of the police because they're trying to provide protection, they are putting women in their cells. Where women flee and they've got nowhere to go because there's no shelter, the women are sleeping with their children or sleeping in the police cells because that's the best the police can offer. So I think we have to really look at what are the consequences of not giving enough resources to the act. So I think just in conclusion, does the Domestic Violence Act work? Yes, it definitely does. And I think for that reason, we definitely must put more resources into making it work more effectively. But it also doesn't work. I think some of the interviews that have looked at women after the time for protection find that for some women, the abuse gets worse. Their husbands are extremely angry and hurt them harder. So, yes, the protection order works for some women. It makes some men very upset and they behave themselves. Others, it makes worse. So I think we must look at where... So that's important because it tells us we have to think about other ways of protecting women. We can't just give them protection orders because it's not going to work for every woman. I think another benefit of the Domestic Violence Act that we must take into account is that, again, looking at the interviews that have been done with women, even if it doesn't necessarily protect them, just the act of going to court and applying for a protection order can leave some women feeling very empowered. It can have a positive effect on them. So I think, again, just to emphasize that although I might have highlighted a lot of the weaknesses in the act, it's definitely not a failure, it's definitely not a waste of time. It is doing good and important things for women. We just need to look at how we can make it better. And I've spoken about the risks. They have partners who respond badly as well as family members. And we have to take that into account that even if family is not getting in the way, the courts are getting in the way, which we don't want to have happening. So just some concluding thoughts. I mean, I think I've given you a lot of statistics and facts and figures. And I don't think they can ever really capture the full extent of the suffering and misery that's imposed by domestic violence. But I think these studies, even though they can't tell us how terrible it is to live like this, do start to show us where the problems and the answers lie. So, I mean, in 2001, researchers already noticing there are no criteria for means testing in place. It's a problem that in 2009 that's still the case. In the voting National Assembly in 1998, already questions have been raised in the parliamentary debate about where's the budget. You can still ask that same question in 2009. In 2000, we had the Department of Justice say, we don't have enough staff. It's still the case in 2009. The ICD in their first report to Parliament in 2000 said the police are not complying with the Domestic Violence Act. They're still saying that in 2008. Pilot Family Courts, we had five established in 1996. In 2009, we still only had five pilot family courts. So I think where to? My one suggestion may be, I think, for if this committee could consider holding public hearings to coincide with 10 years of the Domestic Violence Act implementation. I think we've seen these problems. They've been here for a long time. In 5 years' time, I don't think any of us want to be sitting here again making the same comments. So I think the hearings could be a very important way to think about how can we go forward. And I think this committee could possibly consider a national strategy to tackle domestic violence, which should include how we address the under-resourcing of the Act, its under-prioritization, the under-training of court personnel, as well as non-compliance. Then I think in the same way that the Domestic Violence Act places obligations on the police, you know, to test and go and find shelter, go and find counseling, take them on for medical treatment, but it places no obligations on health to provide that treatment, provides no obligations on the Department of Social Development to provide services. That needs to be addressed. I think we also need to start looking at the links between housing and domestic violence. Women cannot live in shelters forever. And very often their only option is to go straight back to, there is no other housing. They have to go back to the man. So I think it's time we start thinking about housing as a domestic violence issue. We also need to be thinking about norms and standards for the provision of legal, health and social services. It's all very well having staff, but if your staff have not been properly trained, you're still not offering an adequate service. They will still turn people away. So I think we need norms and standards around what is the level of training that is required for people to work in this area. I think we also need to look at the status of family law within the legal system as a whole. This is not just, I think, within government services. It's the legal profession. Family law, you could call the neglected stepchild. A lot of resources don't get given to it, whether it's in family courts or whatever. It goes to the criminal courts. So I think, and as a final issue, I think because I spoke earlier about the relationship between children and child abuse and domestic violence, again, one wants to emphasize the need that there must be a link created between the two. When social services looks at problems of child abuse, they should be starting, and children's organizations, they should be asking what's happening to the mother. And I think when we look at domestic violence, we should equally, in terms of looking at the mother, be asking what is happening to those children. So I think there's a need to start thinking about how we link the two. So that's at the end of my presentation. I hope it's given you lots of thoughts and perhaps some ideas on what we can do to strengthen what is a good act, even if it doesn't work for everybody. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chacharana. You say that the act works and it does not work. So it's just it's one thing. It's either it's working or it's not working. Not to say, I wouldn't agree if you say it works for some and it doesn't work. I mean, if we pass law, it should work for everybody. That's how I understand it. So if it doesn't work, then it's a problem. And also, I'm also concerned on the issue of the underfunding of family courts, and because I would think that if we build families, then we would avoid, you know, crime. Even in your presentation, it's nowhere where you talk about family advocates and so forth, and they should be in the forefront of all this. So it shows that family courts and family advocates are underutilized. And also, we actually queried this, or we are querying it, as to why this act, I mean, it has been passed in 1998. But also, you know, when we have presentations like this, also it doesn't make sense not to have justice here and also the police here. Because we would be querying them, and we are querying you, and you are presenting to us. We would be asking them, why are you not doing this? Why do you have a problem of issuing of these documents and so forth? But let's give it to the floor and hear what members have to say. But let's mainly stick on the problems of implementation.
Thank you. I'm not going to ask a question, but I'd like to make a comment. Because I wrote it down before you came to your conclusion, I see it's part of your challenges. I'm very concerned that when it comes to these sports, that when you make application first for the interdict, the courts only do it in the morning. You come there in the afternoon, they're very upset. Number two, when it comes to the court itself on a jury day, then everyone is in the same courtroom. And to me, that could be a barrier to applying for interdict, or it could be a deterrent. It could be both. Because you can dissuade people from abusing. Because I know the police said, I listened at a function, and they said when it came to this wealthy man, they said, everyone will be here in your business, so support your wife economically. So to me, that is problematic. And then the other problem I have, too, is, like you said, oh, this is what the police must do. But I know about a case where the husband pointed the gun at the woman, and the police were standing there, and they didn't do anything. And where the husband's brother was in the department intervened, don't take him to jail. But now, you know, and I think those are problems our women are sitting with. Because they don't know where to turn to. And I think there should be more education to understand. Because if that woman didn't have someone to help her, then a brother have got away, a husband would have got away, etc. And then also something that plays a very important role to is culture or perhaps tradition. Because for the first time I could see, you know, that husband was upset with this one case. We had to go back to his mother and his wife got into the house. And it doesn't happen in culture. It's just a comment because I would like to question you. Because these questions, as the chairperson said, we have to give to our department. But thanks a lot. It was very interesting, and a person learned from it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, chairperson. And let me also thank the presenter, Tswarana. And gaps. As my previous colleague has indicated that, you know, it's this exercise for us, it's very difficult for us to question, you know, what you have actually highlighted, because this is the true fact of the matter. You know, women abuse is irrespective of whether we are black, we are white, and also politically, you know, it doesn't differ. So I have only one, a strong recommendation to make that. I think our role here is to ensure that, this is adequately resourced.
Mm-hmm.
Because everything happens because of under-resourced.
Mm-hmm.
But you must also remember that initially we didn't have a women's ministry. And therefore, all other institutions that we had no chief. So maybe it will be quite different, the report, from the ones that have been being presented, because precisely of the ministry that we are now having, which we will be able to account, because previously no one could account. However, Chair, like I'm saying that I don't have, much to ask, because most of the things that you raised are our concerns, also, especially when you come to the victims going to report cases whereby there's no privacy. I think that is very important, that inhibits and also discourages them from going there. So I think it's one amongst others that we really have to look into as women. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you for a good presentation. The Chelsea Wimbers talk more about implementation, which is right, and strengthening the act. To do that, the one area that I think should have been touched just briefly while you're doing your research was to ask these people, why is the family abuse? Because for as long as conditions produce this, there'll be too many people who are abused, and all the time there'll never be enough resources. So while we're tackling the issues of the police at that end, we should at the same time tackle the cause root of this, if we can. I mean, I'm just thinking quickly, Chair, of an example of at a hospital where in a ward they were treating injuries. They reported to local government that in this particular township, corner this street and this street and this street, over a weekend we get about 20 injuries from car accidents. And the traffic department just put robots there, and that solved the problem at the hospital. So the one thing I'm saying is to try and get to the cause root, so that while we are addressing the issue of protections and so on, we can also at the same time address this issue that caused. I mean, family unit is the basic unit in our society. And if we don't address these destabilization conditions, the main reason we're producing them and we're treating the symptom rather than the cause. That's the first question. The last brief question, internationally, how are we comparing? Because it's also important to compare ourselves so that we can copy from those societies where they've got low levels of domestic abuse, what their conditions are, how they are handling it, and so on and so forth. Thank you very much.
Also, just so that we do not forget as members, I think this is one of the questions that we need to pose to the governance and monitoring cluster, the issue of funding of family courts. Note that. So one of you will pose that question to the CAP.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I would like to thank the presenter for the information given to us, because it's exactly what's happening in our areas where we stay. I'm not sure whether previous speakers are right. I'm not asking a question. I'm just commenting, because it's clear to us that there's too much to be done by this committee. We must go back, refer to different departments. They must come and tell us exactly what are they doing, because our subs is lacking training. They should be trained. Magistrates, courts must be trained, because we'll find that in some areas, when a woman goes to report such an abuse, they take you to a small claim court, which you just sit there, terms with a clerk, and
they ask you what happened, the husband is in front of you, they say, go back and talk to that, and end of the story. And we, that poor woman is continuing to be abused. Secondly, this thing of that you must go to the sheriff on your own. Because in the first place, as a woman, you're being abused, you are sent pillar to post. The distance in between is too far. It needs money for you to arrive at that place. And some women are not working, there's no money. And they are, and when they arrive there again, it's another story. The process starts again. A sheriff is not available, come at the following day. Poor woman, you pay taxi to arrive there. You must pay the sheriff before that protection order is delivered to your place. So there's a lot to be done by this committee. But what I'm trying to say, I'm thanking you very much for you to letting us know exactly that the Domestic Act we passed, it's not working completely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jefferson. Thank you very much for the presentation. Mine is just a comment. I am a bit disturbed here about this document because I am a woman, and only to find that we are being treated like this. It's heartbreaking. I have just one suggestion, Chairperson. It seems that we had a bit from the justice and a bit from the police. It seems everybody's passing the buck. So I am for public hearing. That can't we just go head on and have public hearings with police and justice invited? Because we know that there's a saying that I like in Afrikaans, and they say, Elke steekie wors het twee punte. If they are here, I can alles hoor en luister. So please, women are dying and women are suffering. It's for us as a new committee to do something. This is, it shows that I agree with the lady that said, the honorable member, it's a new committee. But I think the more we invite, the heartbreak we hear. Thank you, Chair.
It is a new committee, but you know, in my view, if we could perhaps just tackle perhaps just two legislation, like this one, perhaps, and the Children's Act. Over, even if it's over the 5 years, it should satisfy some of us. Rather than sitting here for 5 years and we've got nothing to present. And you mentioned that you are supporting the issue of public hearings with justice, the police, and I would say, and the victims, some of the victims as well, so we could. And
thank you, Chair. I endorse what has been said by most people. It's horrifying, but we thank you for opening our eyes. We are aware of the problems, but perhaps not always of the detail of the problems. I would like to know about training, and possibly this is the information we can get from police or magistrates and so on. What sort of training are they given? Obviously, when they train in the colleges. But is there any sort of updating? Because I think once you go out as a raw recruit, you've got one picture, but once you've been in the field for a while, you get a different idea. So I don't know whether you can answer this, but this is certainly something we need to follow up. And then I think women are unaware of what their rights are in many cases. Or even if they are, they still are victims of abuse, whether they are rich or poor. The way the clerks and the magistrates sometimes just take the side of the men, they, you know, people are victims a second time. So I'd like to know what we can do as a committee, or whether if this is purely the role of the NGOs, to get out there and set up training courses for women in the rural areas in the cities, because most people don't know what their rights are. But if you come armed with knowledge, if you can set up support groups for women as well, I think that could be a benefit to all.
Now also we need to establish as to who should be trained. Is it the victim or the police or justice? In my view, it's the victim. Because once the victim knows their rights, I think everything will flow. Because with the police and justice, what do they need training on? The document is clear, they can just go through it and understand it. They don't really need training. I think we should stick our training to the victims mainly.
Chair, I agree with you. The victims definitely need help. But I know a particular woman in my constituency who has been there, and she's strong and she knows her rights, but she was messed around by the clerks, the magistrates or whatever. So I think perhaps they learnt all these things long ago in the past, but it's gone to the back of their minds. And if they can have refresher courses and it can come with the authority that we are putting on it, they will just have to pull up their socks, because very often they don't care. Very often too, though, the problem is that the courts are overburdened. They are under-resourced, they are understaffed, and they also lose heart. So, you know, we've just got to help them to gain a bit of encouragement again. Perhaps we need to look at the resources that comes with funding to have more staff available, to have more magistrates, to have more social workers. It's a vicious circle, I think.
Are you fine? Do you want another round? Only the Marjuna.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you anyway for the presentation. I don't even have a question because these are frightening stories and we know about them. But my only concern is about the missing of the entries from the domestic violence register. What do we do afterwards? Do we do a follow-up? Or are there people who can do the follow-up, maybe the police or the social workers? And from the figures you just gave to us now, are these figures also including women with disabilities? I think that's about it. Thanks.
And also we have another stand around the sexual offences register.
Yes.
We have been told to compile that it would need something like 300 million. Mm. Then that just tells us it will never happen. Mm. I mean, if we don't have resources for this, where would we get resources for the... For the register. I think as a committee, for once we are in agreement on the public hearings, I think we will discuss that amongst ourselves, but I think we are for that. And you know, sometimes we need to break a record as this committee.
Mm-hmm.
And not support some of the budgets that are presented, some of the votes. Why should we agree and support a budget that is not effective? I mean, to our scope of work. I don't know whether it has happened before or whether it is allowed, but I'm just thinking, every year we pass a budget supporting that particular department. So what are we actually supporting? That our Domestic Violence Act has not been implemented, is that what we support? We would call the department, you know, tell them how we feel about some of these legislation that have not been passed, and alert them that if you don't implement this, we will not support your budget. Simple. Because I think it's like making a mockery of ourselves or of our committee. We support your budget, but you don't support us. It's actually telling us that. Honorable
Chairperson, we'll support your bank. The only place that I know that the speaker in Uganda course, there was an issue on cervical cancer, and it was not budgeted for. She sat there, and she told the women, I'm going to support you. Let us not support the health budget. So that can take place. So we are with you. We won't support the budget.
But you must tell you'll be very unpopular.
I like your militant approach. That's fantastic. Let's do what we have to do. But let's also be proactive. Mm-hmm. I think I've made the suggestion before that we as a committee must take part in the budgeting process.
Mm-hmm.
And when the MTEF comes up and all those things, we should be making our inputs now mm-hmm. to those who are starting to compile the budget so that these points can be made right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then if they are not met, then of course, you know, we've got far more legitimacy for objecting.
Can we then say thanks to Swaranang? Swaranang. What does Swaranang mean? Yes. Holding together.
Okay.
Bambanan.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we'll Bambanan with you.
There was a question as to how our act compared internationally. I must say, our act is regarded as one of the better examples of domestic violence internationally. It's regarded as a very progressive piece of legislation. And it's also, I think, influenced other African countries. Both Botswana and Zimbabwe have incorporated and used elements of our act. So I think it's a very well-regarded act, just to respond to your question.
We need to work around the implementation. Thanks, then, to Choranang. They could be part of the second presentation if they so wish. But we have what you call RAPCAN. Briefing by the RAPCAN, it's an NGO, on the impact of Sexual-Related Matters Act and Domestic Violence Act on children. Are they present? Are you comfortable there? Okay. And to Choranang, thanks also. Your hot copy was well done. And the issue of the PowerPoint, I think it helps us a lot. It shows that you are prepared for the presentation. Thanks a lot. Just briefly introduce yourself and tell us who you are, what you do, who is with you today.
Good morning, and Madam Chair and Honourable Members, thank you very much for the opportunity today. So that I need to lean so forward. My name is Sam Waterhouse. You'll see me officially as Samantha Waterhouse to avoid confusion about my gender, which the name Sam generally creates a lot of confusion in the current context of gender identities in this country. I represent an NGO, as you mentioned, RAPCAN, which has a very long name. RAPCAN is an acronym for Resources Aimed at the Prevention of Child Abuse and Neglect. And I'm supported here today by my colleague, Fairuz Nagyaludi, who's at the back of the room, providing a range of forms of support. I will introduce RAPCAN in a bit more detail in the presentation, so if I may begin. But again, just to note, we really do appreciate the opportunity. We are excited by the work of this committee and the possibilities that it represents. So we're very pleased and happy to be here. Just in terms of what I will present on, there were some differences of understanding in our communication. So what you see very formally as a comment on the sexual offences legislation and the Domestic Violence Act, I've actually commented more broadly on legislation. I have refrained from going into detail around the content of legislation because I understand that you have received some briefings on legislation, and certainly my organization will make itself available if you would require further information about any of the legislation that we speak about. I have seen in your minutes that you were recently briefed, for example, by the Department of Justice on a range of legislation. So what I'm really going to look at is the issue of violence in society, and I've focused on violence against children specifically, but I am looking at violence in society, and I'll explain how I get to that. In the context of prevention, which linked to some of the comments of members in the previous discussion, what is it that we're doing upstream or earlier on to, as a society, and particularly in terms of the legislative and the policy framework, to affect change in society? And I'll talk to the ways in which just some pieces of legislation can address that. My organization is relatively old now. It's 20 years old this year. We share also the anniversary of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which turns 50 this year, which I must punt in this moment. Noting that we are a child rights organization, that we, within that, child rights are very broad. We could be talking socioeconomic rights, we can be talking rights to participation, we can be talking about rights to freedom from violence and so on. So there's a very broad range of rights, and our organization is focused more specifically on the issue of children as victims and on the issue of children who are developing problematic behavior, so who may become offenders later or who are showing behavior-related problems. And as I say, we work very much within a prevention framework, so trying to understand not just what do we do once violence has happened, but how do we try and prevent that more? What do we do in the society to shift the patterns that are so entrenched at this point? In terms of our service delivery, we are very locally based. So we deliver services at a range of courts to children who are witnesses. We provide preparation and support, particularly in sexual offense matters, but also in other cases where children are witnesses. And we see thousands of children in this province every year who are going through the court system. So you'll see a lot of emphasis in my presentation on the issue of sexual offenses because of that. But in addition to that, we're focused very much more at a provincial, national, and then regional, particularly in the SADC region, not necessarily the whole African region, at issues of resources, capacity building, research, to ensure that at a bigger scale we're understanding these issues. So really the service delivery work has two purposes. It keeps us grounded in terms of what it is we are seeing. It helps us with our research. But also, I think very importantly, the service delivery is about testing models. And it's a role that NGOs play, which is to find ways of doing things differently, and then hopefully government will take those up and start implementing these different methods. So it's those two purposes. The organization is committed to what we refer to as evidence-based practice. So it's very important to us that we put a lot of work into making sure that what we do is going to be something reasonable to meet the needs and hopefully make a difference. So we're trying not to have what we would refer to as knee-jerk or common sense responses, whereby we see a problem and think this is a good way to solve it, and we maybe put a lot of resources into something that doesn't have the impact that it's needed to have. So a lot of our work is about testing things on the ground in different social contexts, both in urban and rural environments, in different provinces as well. A lot of our projects are tested in order to try and see scale up of very necessary services. I wanted to address the committee, before I get into the legislation, a little bit on the issue of prevention, because it is our experience that as a society we don't really understand prevention very well. We think about it largely as something awareness raising, information giving, and so in the context of children, awareness prevention is often considered to be when we tell children about their bodies and that no one can touch their bodies. And we find that doesn't really help children very much, because they're in relationships with adults who are touching their bodies where they can't say no to those adults for a range of constructed reasons. So prevention is about understanding what is it that's going on that's enabling these things. And we heard one of the honourable members speaking about causes. We would talk a lot more about risk factors as well.
Prevention is cited at three levels. We look at primary prevention, which are the broad-based projects, the things that we throw out into big communities or into society more broadly to address the range of risk factors. For example, we may see parenting programs being rolled out at scale to anybody who will access them. Social security, access to social security is considered a mechanism of prevention. And, of course, quality education is another classic and very important mechanism of prevention. And these are things that are put out there very broadly. Secondary prevention, you may hear more, and in the Children's Act, you'll hear it referred to as early intervention. So those two terms can be used interchangeably. The primary, secondary, and tertiary model is the World Health Organization type model that we're using. But certainly in our law, it's referred to as early intervention, and it's where you're starting to see problems existing, and then you bring in some measures. It may be the same parenting program that you would use more broadly that you're bringing into a family where there's difficulties and there's a need for more strength. We also see programs targeted at drug, alcohol use here. Children having difficulty learning, you may put an early intervention program in place. And then the thing about which I think all of us are much more familiar, and the programs certainly in terms of government that are more entrenched, are the tertiary prevention programs. The things we do after the fact, after the harm has been caused, we're doing things that are supposed to have some preventative impact. So the criminal justice system is supposed to have some measure that is also preventing future crime. It's supposed to be some kind of deterrent is also to crime, and it's a classic tertiary prevention mechanism. But treatment programs for, in our context for sex offenders, young sex offenders, for example, may apply here. For drug and alcohol, which is very, very topical at the moment as well, would all be examples of tertiary prevention. And these three layers are equally important. They all have a role to play. And one of the issues that we have been facing and been talking about, particularly through the development of the Children's Act, is the fact that we have focused a lot of our efforts on this tertiary level. So a lot of money, resources, and training goes into what happens after the fact. And we're really struggling to figure out how do we shift that pattern and the spending to a model where we're spending more money early on and preventing the need for those later models. It means that there's going to be a phase or a period of time where we have to spend on both before you should start to see the need for spending on the other side drop. We can't stop our spending at this point at the tertiary level. But as long as we continue as we have for the last very long time, I want to say 15 years, but much longer than that, to ignore the needs at a primary prevention level, we will continue to see this increased need of spending. In policing, for example, we've seen over the last 10 years the police have spent so much more money on employing more police officials. That hasn't brought the rates of crime down. It has, in fact, brought the rates of crime up in terms of the recorded rates, simply because investing at this level will help us do better with what's happening, but is not stopping that it's happening in the first place. The CSIR have research, which also, and we see this also on a global scale, which indicates that you get much higher returns also on the investment, that prevention must be seen as an investment in our society. And it was a major shift that was made by Parliament in relation to the Children's Act, where they have emphasized the necessity of spending on prevention programs by the provincial government. In terms of understanding violence, and I opened by saying that I represent an organization working with violence against children, but in fact I'm speaking about violence in society. It is very clear that our experiences in childhood feed into our behaviors and our choices in adulthood, that the number of adult men abusing their female partners did not suddenly at the age of 19 or 21 or 30 decide today I'm going to start being a violent person. That there's a lot that's happening in childhood. And so as our organization has done work looking at how do we address violence against children, it's very clear that actually we would be addressing violence in society if we're targeting interventions at the family level and at children. It won't necessarily help us in the next 5 years, but it will help us in the next 50 years.
want to note that there's this idea about risk and protection, that there are certain things that increase the risk that someone would be a victim or a perpetrator of violence. And there are certain things that decrease that risk, and those are the protective factors. Research shows us very strong similarities between the risk of someone becoming a perpetrator or a victim. So there are differences, and I've lumped a lot of stuff together here that would be in discrete research. You'd see a whole range of different lists, but you'll find these common threads across. So if I do research, which I did for Parliament around the Child Justice Act, on what is the risk of developing young sex offending behavior, and if I do research into what is the risk associated with developing adult violent behavior, or becoming a victim of rape, or becoming a perpetrator of rape as an adult, you find the same things over and over and over again. It's the same set of social factors that are influencing this bigger stuff that we're now trying to address. So the thing that we see is histories of violence, histories of sexual violence, particularly high levels of stress. And when we talk about poverty, we often fail to think about the stress, the added stress that's associated with the struggles related to poverty. Substance abuse, both in victims and in offenders. In the context of child abuse, families where there's substance use doesn't necessarily mean that that drunk family member abuses the child, but the drunkenness in the family. I'm sorry, I'm a bit sick, so my words are slurring. I'm not drunk. The drunkenness in the family is, I'm pleased to hear that. Clear-eyed still. The drunkenness in the family enables somebody else to come in. So you're seeing it quite pervasively in a range of different ways that it increases the risk. The sense of male entitlement, our patriarchal systems, women's bodies being the property of men, women's decision-making being at the wishes of the men in their life, and likewise for children. A very strong feature is poor relationships in families, parents and children or adults and children. It doesn't have to be the biological parents. Not having strong bonds. They're not communicating well. They're not expressing their care and love well. Is a major feature throughout. Poverty, I mentioned. Quality education is another feature, very, very powerful. It's not just access to a classroom. It's access to learning in the classroom. And people who are not learning in schools and are dropping out, you're seeing a pathway that they're following that is leading to 10 years down the line, the kinds of people in society that we don't know what to do with. And then, of course, it's pervasive exposure to violence through domestic violence, through community violence, through violence against children, extreme corporal punishment, all of those things we're seeing very strong links, very strong links to people developing violent behavior. And what happens is we normalize violence. It becomes an acceptable way of coping and of particularly expressing yourself in relation to people who are considered weaker or less powerful than you are. I'm going to move from these. I just want to touch on some legislation, and I'm not going to go into as much depth as I would have liked to, but in the interest of time, I've tried to constrain myself or restrain myself. But there's a couple of pieces of legislation that are very powerful, not just in their addressing tertiary needs, so child and youth care facilities, children's courts, domestic, all of those things, but also are very strong in enabling us to start implementing in programs that will have a more broad prevention impact. But we don't have a comprehensive policy framework, so it's piecemeal, and that's why I'm jumping all over the show in terms of legislation. Importantly, I've mentioned the Children's Act, and particularly the Amendment Act, has sections relating to prevention. The Prevention and Treatment of Substance Abuse Act also has lovely provisions around implementing programs for preventing this more broadly in society. Child justice legislation, not addressing necessarily primary prevention, but gives us a lot of space to engage with secondary prevention. And that's your early intervention programs, I suddenly can't think, diversion programs. So I do understand your presentation. Just to note, this section, it's 144 and 145 in the Children's Act, lists a kinds of things we would consider in prevention programs, and you see its focus is largely on the family, largely on strengthening parents, strengthening the engagement in families and the way that, people parent. But in addition, you see access to therapeutic programs like counseling and then your diversion programs and so on. It has a very important clause also which talks about focusing programs in the most, the least resourced communities. And another important provision is that it needs to, prevention is also about assisting families in obtaining the basic necessities of life, food, shelter, water, etc. The Child Justice Act, and I do, I believe you were briefed on it. I've read the briefing. I'm not sure if it was actually made. But it is innovative in the way it approaches child justice, and it is broadly looking at prevention and trying to stop the cycles and intervene in the cycles. But in both the Child Justice Act, and if I go backwards to the Children's Amendments Act, the big issue there is the availability of programs. So we've got the framework now in the law, which we want, and we want to keep it. But we stand the high risk of sitting here in 5 and 10 years' time not having implemented that because we don't have programs. And that is about, again, putting good programs in place and being able to scale them up in society. And it is the challenge of the departments concerned, social development, justice in this instance, to ensure that we have programs that are actually available to the people that the law gets into. Otherwise, all that happens is we have it in law, but we keep using that tertiary system. And then there's this very long list of potential legislation that we can see prevention having relevance in. Housing laws, as Lisa has spoken about, but also in relation to children, housing is very important. Education laws broadly, social security, firearms, liquor, DVA we've spoken about, health-related laws. So there's a lot of legislation where we could sit and really say, what about this enables prevention? What about this can we use to strengthen the fact that at a later date someone abuses somebody else? And there's a lot of research and understanding of what that is. As the organization, as I said at the beginning, we're working with a lot of children in court and have worked a lot on the sexual offences legislation. So the rest of my presentation, I'm going to be looking at laws that look at that tertiary level prevention, and I'll spend a bit more time on sexual offences. We recognize and have participated in the various processes, the positive developments that this Act represents. There's a lot of good. I've heard you mention some of the what I would call the so-so provisions, or the is it good or is it bad provisions, such as the register. There are other provisions relating to HIV that have very strong positive aspects but also very strong negative aspects as well. And I've chosen in the interest of time not to talk to those things, but they are very important areas. The proliferation of registers and so on is again a classic example, as you spoke, Chair, in relation to spending money where it may not be best used. And some of us might say, are we wasting money? But some of the problems are in relation to the court experience, and we've just shut down. I'm not sure why we've shut down. I'll leave it to the technicians, but I'll speak to the pages. Talking about the fact that the legislation provided an opportunity for us to change the way in which courts deal with particularly vulnerable witnesses, the methods and the measures that are in place to protect people from further harm and further victimization in court. And we're very disappointed that decisions were taken. We respect why those decisions were taken, but we're very disappointed that the decisions were taken not to be more progressive. A very conservative approach was taken to courtroom practice, which is already the problem in court for children and for women, whereby although we have provisions in Criminal Procedure Act which allow for people to be outside of the court environment, and in you know, using closed circuit television systems and so on, the public to be removed, courts don't like using it. And it's exactly the same point that Lisa raised from Florinung in relation to it's a lottery. The quality of justice that people access at this point in this country is a lottery of where you are when you are harmed. depending on the police who are involved, depending on the prosecutors who are involved, and depending on the magistrate who's involved, you will have very different experiences of your rights to privacy, for example, to dignity, to safety being protected or not. Noting that the court process is by its nature a very difficult adversarial system. It's a system of battling, one party fighting it out against another. And it's an adult-centered environment, so there are lots of reasons to shift the practice in that system. And at this point, those shifts are made on paper. They're made in the Sexual Offences Act. They're made through the directives and the policy, the national instructions, and they're made in the Criminal Procedure Act, but they're not made in courts. It is still the minority. There's a provision in the law that says that an adult woman in a sexual offence case may give her evidence outside of the courtroom through CCTV. I don't know what the research is. Anecdotally, my experience is it is not used. It is not used for adult women. And I'd be very happy for someone to challenge me on that. It is very rarely used for adult women. It is more frequently used for children who are not using a system which has a slightly higher level of protection where there's another person involved. So the law's looking great, but the practice isn't shifting in court. There has been a challenge to this conservative approach that was taken in the law in the Constitutional Court, and in terms of the recognition of the fact that children require, in the main, and certainly in the majority of children, require these protective measures, that challenge has been successful. The final orders of the court are not yet completed in terms of the orders to the department. But this doesn't address the needs of adult survivors at all. It's only addressing children. And again, the court order is going to have one impact, but we're not sure how, again, that will influence what's done in courtrooms. And so the fact that children don't speak in court or don't speak fully in court because they're faced by the person they fear in a system and a process that they're frightened of means that they don't speak. And when they don't speak, it means that you don't get conviction. And when you don't get conviction, it means that the accused is, and they do reoffend. Research is very clear on that. The other big thing that is an issue, not just for the Sexual Offences Act, and you see it in the Children's Act to some degree, is the issue of access to psychosocial therapeutic services. Again, we're focusing on the criminal justice response and not on the needs, the emotional needs of a person to heal and cope with the experience. What that means is when the criminal justice system fails, everything fails. Whereas if you provide counseling and the person is able to at least come to some understanding of their experience and some way of coping with their experience, they haven't lost everything when the criminal justice system fails. There are very few counseling services, particularly in rural areas. I've noted that in an urban area, in the Western Cape and Gauteng, there are waiting lists for children who are considered more worthy of counseling, never mind the adults who don't, who have even less services targeted at them. There are very few counseling services. So we're dealing with huge numbers of people. On an annual basis in this country, if you look at the police statistics and you take into account the under-reporting rates, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people who experience profound trauma, and that profound trauma is not addressed. And research tells us unaddressed trauma is one of the risk factors for people becoming violent themselves. So we're not intervening in the cycle there on a tertiary level where we should be. And it is because it's difficult to do that. The great thing about the sexual offences legislation, and I'm not sure if the committee's aware of it, is that it requires parliamentary oversight on an annual basis. The legislation calls that on an annual basis, the Department of Justice must come and represent the development in the law. And I think my concern is that those provisions won't be seen. We've already struggled. Foreign Lang have also participated, GAP have also participated in the processes of struggling to get certain things brought before the Justice Committee in the previous Parliament. We're hoping that things would go more smoothly in this Parliament, but would really ask this committee to also keep their eye on that. Because it doesn't specify where in Parliament in the law. It says it must be brought before Parliament. So we do ask that. I think this important point, the second bullet here around changing knowledge and practice, the implementation is not going to happen simply, as we know, because the law is printed and available in the desks. People won't read it. And I heard and engaged with the discussion around training, and training is critical both to the users of the legislation, as it were, the victims, the women, the children, the families that are experiencing it, but also to the people supposedly there to implement it. And my experience has been that training alone is not enough. Management and requirements and accountability systems are what helps and makes a difference. If the boss in the province is called to account because the head of a station didn't know that their official on the ground didn't do the job, that's when things start to change. When we hold people accountable, what have you done? Why haven't you done it? Why does this officer not know about this act? At the moment, it just gets left in the hands of the people wearing the uniforms or the prosecutors. And I really do think that we need to look at the accountability system and put a lot more of our effort and implementation in that, as well as those efforts around training. Comments around children and domestic violence have been made by Lisa and are noted. I wanted to point out also that children are, certainly in terms of the research and the work we do with children in their families where they're struggling with a range of these issues, children are victims of domestic violence, either directly because they too are being hit or abused emotionally, but also where they are witnessing it. The research is powerful around the world and in this country to tell us that where children witness domestic violence, they are much more at risk themselves of being victims of violence later or of becoming perpetrators of violence later. There's a distress that children are experiencing, that are living with over extended periods of time in a state of emotional trauma that we're not even looking at. And yes, the Domestic Violence Act does recognize it, but we're not seeing it, as was mentioned, in terms of the services both by the state but also by NGOs. And it's very practical things. Why do we have shelters that don't take boy children over the age of 8 or 12 or whatever the line is that a particular shelter decides? Why is it that in a shelter we'll have counseling for the parents, the mother, but we won't have counseling for the children to recognize their experience? Why are we not focusing on the impact on education on children in shelters? There's a range of things that we're seeing links between children's experience of domestic violence and then children being victims then and there as children, but also creating a whole new population of victims and offenders in the future. Some of my last comments relate to quite a topical area. I'm sure that this committee is aware of the discussions relating to policing and what are known as the FCS units, the Family Violence, Child Protection and Sexual Offence Units. There's been a lot of activity and we're very pleased with the developments in the Ministry of Police over these last couple of months in relation to looking at their plans for it. But I think that we see a trend, and I noted it in the presentation made by Justice to this committee as well, this trend away from specialist services towards generalist services. On the basis that we can't afford to provide specialist services, and I've heard argued, I'm not sure if it was presented to this committee, that we are offering discriminatory services where we're offering a specialized service that not everyone can get it, and therefore we rather have no specialization. What we see this in relation to policing, sexual offense courts, and health facilities. And what we have to note is that these cases, or the cases that are dealt with in these, deal with particularly vulnerable victims. All victims of crime are vulnerable. These are considered extremely vulnerable victims. And then the cases are more complex, both because of the type of trauma, the interpersonal violence, and the impact of that on a person in their understanding of themselves going forward, but also because of the social responses and the justice-type responses that we get, the criminal justice responses. But there's a lot of rejection of victims who come forward. There's a lot of further harm caused. We call it secondary victimization, blaming, and so on that goes on. So these reasons mean and feed into the fact that we know we've got low reporting rates. We know that. We see them improve, which has probably got something to do with the improvement in services. We've got poor prosecution rates. We've got, in some cases, we've got hand-picking which cases will be prosecuted. I was recently told in a court that the sexual offence courts are now seeing other cases, they have to split their court role with the other general courts. We've got the sexual offence court, which has special prosecutors who have training. It's got special mechanisms in place to assist. And then you've got the courts downstairs, which don't have those things. The prosecutors aren't trained, the magistrates don't have expertise, and the equipment is not available. And they said, it's okay, though, we still see all the children in the sexual offences court, so the rat can is appeased. What we do is we send the difficult, the 50-50 cases, was how it was put, downstairs for adults. And then she said, you know those women who really want their day in court, but they've got a very low chance. So what happens when you undermine the specialization is the very cases that need the specialized service, the cases that are socially difficult, are the cases that end up with the worst service. And so the argument is not then to take away those resources, but rather to increase the resources for specialization, which I do believe we can afford. I think it's important also to talk about these different elements, because again, it's that point that is constantly made that specialization is achieved through training. Specialization is achieved through a range of measures, including training, but you need dedicated resources. With the police restructuring, and I have provided copies of the report for the committee from the research that we did, but what you saw was that research resources for services to women and children in these circumstances were taken away. So the police were devolved to local level, but the resources also went to local level. And what it meant was that in an already stretched environment, where police really are stretched for resources, they took away cell phones and cars and so on, which meant basically that you couldn't, we had victims, we had across the country, we had reports from the police themselves where they're struggling because they're having to interview children in rooms with three other or four other detectives sitting around them. They don't have child-friendly spaces. So children are coming into busy spaces and being asked then to talk about their experience. They're no longer able to drive out to the home of the victim, which is one way of minimizing trauma. The victim must be brought into them. We're still transporting victims and perpetrators together to court in one van. It's still something that happens. And the police themselves on the ground are expressing their distress at this. So we need resources in budgets that are dedicated to this kind of service. We saw it a little bit in the SAPS budgets about 5 years ago where in the detective services it was explained that particular amounts were for these specialized services. But in addition, we make the assumption that anybody can do this work. And time and again, anyone doing this work well will tell you not anybody can do this. We need to have systems in place for recruitment. We need to be asking, on what basis did you choose that detective or that prosecutor to do this work? Because as long as we expect that every person in this society can somehow have the skills to work with traumatized people or to work with children who, I mean, you go ask your child, how was your day? What happened at school? Nothing. It's very difficult to communicate with children generally. It's also very difficult to communicate with people who've been traumatized and who have experienced difficulties in a system that doesn't trust them. So we need to look at the recruitment processes. Yes, then we need, as was discussed, the issue of training, the initial and ongoing training processes for these people. But most critically, it comes down to leadership. Our research tells us that when you've got a good leader who understands these issues and knows what it takes to investigate or prosecute these properly, they will run a team that is skilled. They will pick the right people for the job. They will make sure that the job gets done properly. So really, as far as I'm concerned, it's about leadership at a local level. And that's where a lot is going wrong in terms of our implementation. We look at police policy, and it is really, really good. But it doesn't translate onto the ground. And I think that we've invested a lot in training, and people get trained, and if they don't have to do the job and they didn't really want to do it in the first place, they won't do the job. And if they did want to do the job in the first place, they will do the job. So I do think that there's a whole lot that needs to be said around the ability to manage these things at a local level, at courts, police stations, and hospitals. So what we've seen is this movement towards a more generalist approach. It's reverses the developments that have been made in this country over the last 15 years. There's been, in the last 5 years or 3 years, or you started hearing the talk 5 years ago, these inroads into something that was considered a positive development, a strength in this country around specialized services. What we see in evidence, and I haven't quoted all the research, but I certainly can make it available to the committee, you see that where there's specialization, the clients are saying they felt better about the service. There's a much better service being delivered. You see through research done, for example, by Tsuonan, much better quality of investigation. Cases are more likely to get followed through into court. The evidence is better, and that strengthens the case. And then from the NPA's reporting, we see that it has a positive impact on conviction rates. And so we've got these things that are shown to work that, in my view, we can afford, but of course that's my view, but which can be put in place. And instead of strengthening that, we've gone the other way and we're saying, actually, we don't want to go down this road anymore. We want to offer everybody the service from everybody. Research that we did into looking at what countries like South Africa, so other developing countries are doing, not the first world countries, countries like Argentina, India, Chile, what are they doing around the issue of specialization? And there we see across the board strong political leadership on the issue, that you find there's a political champion for these kinds of issues and for the best way in which to deal with these issues. And that seems to be filtering down into a practice at a local level. And I've noted already the developments in terms of policing and courts. So, just some kind of concluding comments and things to think about going forward. I don't think that it's necessarily all of this is new, or if any of it, I would have some of it, but it's new to the committee. But absolutely to pick up on the points around enhancing our lens and our view of this issue of primary and secondary prevention. Keep our eye on it so that we are ensuring that we're enabling its implementation. And you'll find that because it's not the practice, people tend not to present on it. So when you call a department to speak to, they're going to speak about what they're doing more than what they're not doing. Surprisingly. And to understand the intersections in legislation and policy, I'm not quite sure how that bracket got put in there, and I do apologize. Oversight, I love you know, that this committee has focused on that and that you've been very strong on this issue. I think it is what it's about, calling people to account, calling people to come and explain to you what they're doing. And I really, as I say, I respect the approach that has been taken. Then the mechanisms to implement I've spoken about a little bit. It's more than just awareness. There's a new Domestic Violence Act. It's more than just training. This is the content on the Act, but it's also the systems of holding people accountable at local level. The big challenge, as mentioned earlier, is the issue of programs that work. We, for example, see people taking children to prisons to show them how bad criminal behavior is, and we see showing children what drugs look like to help them not take drugs. A lot of money can get spent doing those sorts of things, and it doesn't make a difference. In fact, children coming from violent communities going to prison may actually idolize and find it quite something to aspire to. And we see this in our work in a community where it is not unusual for 6- and 7-year-olds to take a which is communicating with prison language around prison gangs because their family members are in prison. And studies that were done also show that significant proportion of South Africa's children, have family members or friends or significant people in prison. So there's something about that is your path and your ideation. So we need things that are evidence-based. We need things that will work and will make a difference. And to do that, we need testing processes. We need money to do research around whether they work. And then we need departments ready to scale up. So we've seen this in terms of the provision of court preparation by the National Prosecuting Authority. NGOs have been delivering court preparation. The National Prosecuting Authority has come in and tried to take that over, which is a great development. It's what we want to see. The only thing is when government takes something over, we don't want them to drop the quality of that program. It's too expensive. We provide food to all the children coming into our courts because our children who come to our service don't have food in the mornings. They're sitting waiting long periods of time, and we all know, as you're feeling right now, I'm sure, that when we sit without food, our blood sugar drops and we don't concentrate well. Mm-hmm. We're asking children to speak in that environment, so we give them food. The NPA is saying we can't give them food. It's just not even an option for us. We supervise our people working with children. We don't expect people to do a good job without supervision. The NPA can't put the supervision stuff in place if they're not doing it. So we want to see government taking on the project. We want to see these core elements of what makes a good program held, and it is about spending. So we have the legislation, and we shudder to think that we would lose some of the gains in legislation. I fear what could happen if we don't get if we don't implement some of these things. Will we lose these provisions? Or will we give ourselves time? And with respect, 5 years, I understand, is a term of office, but we need to have an even longer term view for the good of the change. You know? So we need to say, what is the 5-year plan? What is the 10-year plan? And then, critically important, and it came up in your discussions earlier, is the issue of budget allocations in provinces. Where budget is allocated nationally, it doesn't define how that money will be spent in the province and what the priorities will be in the province. And that's why the provisions in the Children's Act are so important, where those must and may provisions that the minister or the MEC must provide the prevention services and so on. But we need to be monitoring that. And it is in everybody's interest to ask those questions about what's happening at a provincial level. And then the capacity to spend the money. I think if I look back at where we fail, people aren't able to spend money well. And I think that we could use a lot more programs in government and also obviously with NGOs, but particularly in government, to build our capacity to spend wisely, but to spend. And then for us, our role remains to continue to represent our clients' interests and needs and concerns, where possible to enable our clients themselves. So in my context, we work on children being able to on their own behalf, capacitating victims of crime to speak on their own behalf at a policy level. Also for NGOs, we continue to support implementation. We do support government as much as we can and where we are welcome, which we are in a lot of spheres, in developing materials, providing training, providing support. Very importantly is the issue of monitoring, and I did not go into depth in it, but we are busy with the University of Cape Town and other organizations and networks also with monitoring particularly the sexual offences legislation research. It's still very early days, unlike the DVA where you could get a good idea about how it is 10 years later. So we're busy. We've done a pilot monitoring program with police, justice, and health. There's a separate project going on with health. So that is a role of NGOs as well, to keep that monitoring going. But I do also see that as a role of government and expect government to continue with its efforts. And I spoke about the last 2 points a lot, so I think I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Samantha. Thank you very much. I think your presentation was also very clear and straightforward. You know, we, as members of Parliament, have this oversight tool of ours to monitor and make the executive accountable. But I always have a problem when it comes to holding the officials accountable. I don't know how we need to check that, to how it's done. I mean, how do you hold a police officer who doesn't keep records in their pocketbook and so forth? How do you hold that person accountable? Who are they accountable to? I always have a problem with that. And also, I think even us as members of Parliament, we also need to be trained on the understanding of the budget itself. So once we understand the budget, we know exactly how it should be spent. We can always call the provinces to order if they lack capacity on the spending. But let me open this to members for your inputs, comments, questions, clarity. Robert Robinson.
Thank you, Chair. I was very interested to hear that you said that there was a facility for women to give evidence by camera or whatever, because I've just recently heard of a case where a woman was completely traumatized by seeing her rapist, and it led to a very unfortunate situation. I won't go into details. Could you perhaps tell me more about that? Because it seems that the prosecutors in the court are unaware of this. I simply just protested and said surely they should be kept apart. but I would like to have the evidence to be able to back this up if you could give me that information now or later. Thank you.
Honourable Dorothy. Thank you, Chair, and let me thank the presenter for actually presenting this. I don't have much to ask. You know, my interest would be, do you have any relationship with education? Because, you know, this has much, you know, to do with the school, I think, at an early age. It will benefit them. So I just wanted to know whether you do have a relationship with education. Let me check something. In your research, could you confirm or dispute the fact that there is link between teenage pregnancy and the child support grant? Would you just tell us something on that in your how many hands? It was the first one, the second was a comment. Honorable Ketana?
Yeah, I comment again. No, see, I'm very, very happy with this. In fact, my ears are full. You know, I just like the depth of the presentation. Were you not just treating societal illnesses after the fact, after things have happened? You also trying to address them before the fact, before things happen. You know, the example here is a doctor at the gate here. When you go there, she also is a dietitian, because preventative medicine is what people think we should concentrate on. Who teaches you what to eat? Bad food, good food, before you get ill. So if you wait until people are ill and we allow them to eat all the things that they are not aware will make them ill, we're not getting, you know, we're spending a lot of government money treating the illness rather than preventing. So I'm just saying the depth of this, that says if we are too late, yes, let's treat the illness. Let's act after the fact and implement the act. But also if you could get to the depth of what causes all these illnesses. So I'm very happy. I think you've done a very good job.
Thanks on your behalf. Yeah, this is actually free information. We usually pay for information, but this one is just free to the committee.
Yes.
And we appreciate that so much. Members, let's wait for the responses from Samantha.
Chairperson, I suspect your first comment was not a question, and I shudder to even try and answer it because I understand that it is the issue. How do you hold people accountable? I think, though, that I did want to point out that if you look at the clauses in the sections in the Sexual Offences Act that deal with accountability, there's some quite nice systems that are developed which enable Parliament to do what it can do at its level but require a level of accountability in operations. So it goes, in my view, there's something to be said for writing certain mechanisms into legislation where we might not see it. So it requires policies, it requires directives, it requires that these things be gazetted, and it then requires at least some self-reflection. But I don't think that it will achieve exactly what you suggested. In terms of the provision around closed circuit television for adults, Section 158 of the Criminal Procedure Act, and there is case law which argues that it should be less available and other case law that it argues that it should be more available. But generally prosecutors don't like to make these applications because they extend the period of the trial and they are not very successful. And I think the issue remains, and it strikes me, a colleague of mine was giving expert testimony in the court, and she, with great respect, informed the court that, in fact, it is not about the child meeting the needs of the court, but rather the court meeting the needs of the child. And unfortunately, the system as it is right now is around victims having to meet the needs of the court. Mm-hmm. And we've got these measures that are supposed to modify that environment. Mm-hmm. And effort has been put in by the legislature to think through those measures, and then at the lower level the courts are managing to, I think, ignore the principles and the thinking behind it. We find in the Sexual Offences Act a big criticism is that it emphasises the needs of children under 14, and if children over 14 have less need of these things, and certainly adults, as I mentioned, aren't even featuring as being particularly vulnerable in terms of the Act. And that's a problem, because the Constitution talks about children from 18 and under, and also, as noted, trauma, any of us sitting in this room who are traumatised in such a way would require those kinds of protections, even though we're not 6 years old or 9 years old. But I can speak further. I've got some stuff from Find That Case also. In terms of our relationship with the Department of Education, our organization works very much with education. One of the strong factors we see in prevention, as I mentioned, is that children access good quality education. And that's in terms of understanding curriculum, but it's also in terms of the environment in which you learn. Because if you learn in a disrespectful environment, if the teachers are disrespecting the principal and the learners are disrespecting each other and the teachers and so on, it creates an environment that doesn't value education. So we do a lot of work around capacitating the departments, and particularly at district levels, so not so much at national, to engage with child abuse, so to act as some kind of conduit to what's happening in homes and families, but also a lot of violence in schools work, particularly looking at classroom management issues and capacitating teachers and helping teachers who feel very disempowered to build their skills and capacity to manage very big classrooms. But the issues are so foundational around teachers struggling with the curriculum. Poor leadership in schools is the main factor for a problem school. Where you've got good principals in place, we find you will have a much better school running. Yes, of course, resources are critical and all of those issues. So there's a lot of work we do in education and, you know, in many different areas. In terms of prevention, one of the things we're doing, and it links to the question around pregnancy, is we're currently working with the National Department of Education to develop a pilot pregnancy reduction program, which looks at all those kind of programs we know where you practicing parenting, so kids understanding the budgeting involved and how do you build relationships and so on. But it's also looking at gender issues, HIV issues, relationship, making the choice. We can tell children about HIV and they still don't use condoms, even though they know they must use condoms. That's what the research tells us. We can tell children that you will very likely become pregnant under these circumstances. They don't want to be pregnant, but they still make that mistake. So really, I often say, how do we, when they're slow dancing at the party, the 15-year-olds at the party, and they're dancing with each other, and they feel good, what do we do at that point? What are we doing with young people at the point where they're feeling compelled, for whatever reason, to go on? And it's normally because it feels quite nice. And then we are comfortable with the idea that young people feel quite nice about their bodies. So there's those sorts of things we're trying to also implement, which hopefully would also address violence more broadly in society. On the point of the child support grant, as we hear that it's, people suspect that it promotes children becoming pregnant, research has been done by ACCESS, which is a different organization, but we are a member of that organization, it's a network. And the research very clearly shows that there is no link, that while there probably are a few cases where people are saying, this is why I got pregnant, that's not necessarily teenagers, it may be adult women, but it's really a very small, small proportion of people, that there have always been issues of teen pregnancy. And in fact, in South Africa, the rate of teen pregnancy has been dropping. So if we look over the last 10 years, you're actually seeing a reduction in the rate of young people becoming pregnant. So you're not seeing any correlation with a child support grant and some increase suddenly in levels of pregnancy. The fact is children do become pregnant. It is still most likely that as a South African, you'll have your first child before your 20th birthday. But we're normally talking about people over 17, and that 18, 19-year-old age is the biggest age, not 13, 14 years old, which is also often a concern of people. So the research we have is showing that there isn't a strong link between the grant. And in fact, what the research is showing, that access to the grant, which is a very small amount of money, has a very strong link to children remaining in school. That children in poor families who are on the grant are more likely to be in school for longer than children in poor families who are not on the grant. and that's national research. And I know your researchers have participated in finding those studies and so on, and do have access to that information for the committee. And yes, I would support the comment that prevention is better than cure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Samantha. On that note, we could excuse the members of the civil society and we'll be left alone as a committee. Thank you so much. Thank you very, very much.